Disc 29.
Mason tried to console Hamilton by saying that all men had sinned and were equal in the Lord's sight. I perceive it to be so, Hamilton said. I am a sinner. I look to his mercy. Hamilton also stressed his hatred of dueling. I used every expedient to avoid the interview, but I have found for some time past that my life must be exposed to that man. I went to the field determined not to take his life. As Mason told how Christ's blood would wash away his sins, Hamilton grasped his hand, rolled his eyes heavenward, and exclaimed with fervor, I have a tender reliance on the mercy of the Almighty through the merits of the Lord Jesus Christ. Hamilton, struggling for breath, promised that if he survived, he would repudiate dueling. Rebuffed by Mason, Hamilton redirected his hopes of communion to the skittish Benjamin Moore. The bishop now faced considerable pressure to appease Hamilton, whose friends thought it heartless to refuse a dying man's last wish. This refusal was cruel and unjustifiable, wrote David Ogden. Why deny a man the consolation and comforts of our holy religion in his last moments? Willing to reconsider, the stern prelate with the bald pate and long, grave face returned to the scene at 1 o'clock that afternoon. As befits a great orator, Hamilton roused himself for one last burst of persuasion. My dear sir, he told Moore, you perceive my unfortunate situation and no doubt have been made acquainted with the circumstances which led to it. It is my desire to receive the communion at your hands. I hope you will not conceive there is any impropriety in my request. Then he added, it has for some time past been the wish of my heart, and it was my intention to take an earlier opportunity of uniting myself to the church by the reception of that holy ordinance. Hamilton expressed his faith in God's mercy. When Moore termed dueling a barbarous custom, Hamilton assured him, too, that he would renounce it if he lived. Lifting his hands beseechingly, he said, I have no ill will against Colonel Burr. I met him with a fixed resolution to do no harm. I forgive all that happened. At that point, Moore relented and gave Holy Communion to Hamilton, who then lay back serenely and declared that he was happy. The next morning, Hamilton's mind was still clear, though his strength was depleted and his body motionless. He could speak only with difficulty. Except for one heartbreaking moment, he managed to maintain his exceptional composure. Eliza had not allowed the children into their father's presence the previous day, but she now realized that the time had come for Hamilton to bid them farewell. She held up their 2-year-old boy, Philip, to his lips for a final kiss. Then Eliza lined up all 7 children at the foot of the bed so that Hamilton could see them in one final tableau, a sight that rendered him speechless. According to Hossack, he opened his eyes, gave them one look, and closed them again till they were taken away. In Hamilton's last hours, more than 20 friends and family members pressed into his chamber, most praying on their knees with their eyes fixed on Hamilton's every expression. David Ogden said they gave way to a flood of tears and implored heaven to bless their friend. For some, the death watch became insupportable. The scene is too powerful for me, Governor Morris wrote. I am obliged to walk in the garden to take breath. Morris later recalled the scene around Hamilton, his wife almost frantic with grief, his children in tears, every person deeply afflicted, the whole city agitated, every countenance dejected. Hamilton alone seemed resigned as the end neared. At one point, speaking of politics, he said, if they break this union, they will break my heart. He could have left no more fitting political epitaph. Hamilton repeated to Bishop Moore that he bore no malice toward Burr, that he was dying in a peaceful state, and that he was reconciled to his God and his fate. His faculties stayed intact until about 15 minutes before the end. Then at 2 p.m., on Thursday, July 12, 1804, 31 hours after the duel, 49-year-old Alexander Hamilton died gently, quietly, almost noiselessly. After a frenzied life of passion and drama, of incomparable heights and depths, it proved a mercifully easy transition. Thus has perished one of the greatest men of this or any age, Oliver Wolcott Jr. wrote to his wife. A large bloodstain soaked into the Bayard's floor where Hamilton expired, and for many years the family refused to expunge this sacred spot. Eliza snipped a lock of hair from her husband's head and commenced the long rites of widowhood. She was tortured with grief. The poor woman was almost distracted and begged Uncle Gouverneur Morris might come into her room, said David Ogden. She burst into tears, told him he was the best friend her husband had, begged him to join her in prayers for her own death, and then to be a father for her children. Normally a witty, cosmopolitan man and bon vivant, the peg-legged Morris could only stare at Eliza with tears streaming down his cheeks. We do not know when Eliza first saw the hymn that Hamilton had written for her in the early morning hours before the duel, nor do we know when she tore open the envelope and read the farewell letter that Hamilton had composed for her on July 4th, the day he attended the bittersweet banquet of the Society of the Cincinnati. At some moment during the next few days, a tearful Eliza sat down and read the lines that her dead husband had prepared for her. This letter, my very dear Eliza, will not be delivered to you unless I shall have first terminated my earthly career, to begin, as I humbly hope from redeeming grace and divine mercy, a happy immortality. If it had been possible for me to have avoided the interview, my love for you and my precious children would have been alone a decisive motive. But it was not possible without sacrifices which would have rendered me unworthy of your esteem. I need not tell you of the pangs I feel from the idea of quitting you and exposing you to the anguish which I know you would feel. Nor could I dwell on the topic lest it should unman me. The consolations of religion, my beloved, can alone support you, and these you have a right to enjoy. Fly to the bosom of your God and be comforted. With my last idea, I shall cherish the sweet hope of meeting you in a better world. Adieu, best of wives and best of women. Embrace all my darling children for me. Ever yours, A.H. Chapter 43, The Melting Scene. When a handwritten notice of Hamilton's death went up at the Tontine Coffee House, the city was transfixed with horror. The feelings of the whole community are agonized beyond description, Oliver Wolcott Jr. told his wife. New Yorkers of the era never forgot the extravagant spectacle of sadness, the pervasive grief. Even Burr's friend Charles Biddle conceded that there was as much or more lamentation as when General Washington died. As with Washington, this mass communal sorrow provoked reflections on the American Revolution, the Constitutional Convention, and the founding of the government. Unlike at Washington's death, however, the sorrow was laced with shock and chagrin at the senselessness of Hamilton's demise. Because of Hamilton's relative youth, his large, bereaved family, his extended service to his country, and his woeful end, he achieved in death what had so often eluded him in life, an emotional outpouring of sympathy from all strata of New York society. This reaction was repeated in other former Federalist strongholds, with one Boston cleric telling of streets crowded with those who carry badges of mourning because the first of their fellow citizens has sunk in blood. In Philadelphia, muffled church bells sounded, and newspapers dressed their columns with funereal borders. For the rest of its term, the New York Supreme Court draped its bench in black fabric, while the Bank of New York building was also sheathed in black. For 30 days, New Yorkers wore black bands on their arms. Everybody in New York knew that the city had lost its most distinguished citizen. As statesman Edward Everett later said, Hamilton had set the city on the path to becoming the throne of the Western commercial world. The evening of Hamilton's death, New York's leading merchants exhorted one another to shutter their shops for a state funeral hastily arranged for Saturday, July 14th. The corpse is already putrid, Gouverneur Morris wrote that Friday, and the funeral procession must take place tomorrow morning. Mourners assembled on Saturday morning in front of 25 Robinson Street, today Park Place, the home of John and Angelica Church. The New York Common Council, which paid for the funeral, issued a plea that all business in the city should halt out of respect for Hamilton. It was the grandest and most solemn funeral in the city's history to date. That Saturday morning, guns fired from the battery, church bells rang with a doleful sound, and ships in the harbor flew their colors at half-mast. Around noon, to the somber thud of military drums, New York militia units set out at the head of the funeral procession, bearing their arms in reversed position, their muzzles pointed downward. Numerous clergymen and members of the Society of the Cincinnati trooped behind them. Then came the most affecting sight of all. Preceded by two small black boys in white turbans, eight pallbearers shouldered Hamilton's corpse, set in a rich mahogany casket with his hat and sword perched on top. Hamilton's gray horse trailed behind with the boots and spurs of its former rider reversed in the stirrups. Then came Hamilton's four eldest sons and other relatives, followed by representatives of every segment of New York society. Physicians, lawyers, politicians, foreign diplomats, military officers, bankers, merchants, Columbia College students and professors, ship captains, mechanics, and artisans. Collectively, they symbolized the richly diversified economic and political mosaic that Hamilton had envisaged for America. Conspicuously missing were the female victims of the calamity: Eliza, Angelica Church, and Hamilton's 19-year-old daughter, Angelica. 4-year-old Eliza and 2-year-old Philip also stayed behind with their mother. As the funeral procession wound east along Beekman Street, then down Pearl Street and around Whitehall Street to Broadway, the sidewalks were congested with tearful spectators, and onlookers stared down from every rooftop. There were no hysterical outbursts, only a shocked hush that deepened the gravity of the occasion. Not a smile was visible, and hardly a whisper was to be heard, but tears were seen rolling down the cheeks of the affected multitude, wrote one newspaper. So huge was the throng of mourners that the procession streamed on for 2 hours before the last marchers arrived at Trinity Church. "The funeral was the most solemn scene I ever witnessed," wrote David Ogden. "Almost every person was in tears. Even the rabble of boys and Negroes who filled the streets seemed to partake of the general grief. The windows were crowded with females who were, almost without exception, weeping at the fate of their departed friend." A private drama enacted that day previewed the historical ambivalence that Hamilton was to inspire. Governor Morris had delivered the funeral oration for Washington at St. Paul's Chapel and was drafted to do the same honor for Hamilton. He was so shaken by Hamilton's death that friends thought he might not bear the strain of the address, but his real problems were of an altogether different nature. Instead of rushing to eulogize his friend, Morris first succumbed to a host of doubts and anxieties. In part, he was alarmed by the vengeful outcry against Burr and decided to omit all mention of the duel, lest the vast assembly fly into an uncontrollable fury. "How easy it would have been to make them for a moment absolutely mad," he said. But that problem was manageable compared to how to depict his brilliant but controversial and imperfect friend. For starters, there was the problem of his origins. "The first point of his biography is that he was a stranger of illegitimate birth," Morris confessed to his diary. "Some mode must be contrived to pass over this handsomely." And what about Mariah Reynolds? "I must not either dwell on his domestic life. He has long since foolishly published the avowal of conjugal infidelity." And then Hamilton had never been guilty of modesty. "He was indiscreet, vain, and opinionated. These things must be told, or the character will be incomplete, and yet they must be told in such a manner as not to destroy the interest." Perhaps most problematic was the controversial bargain that Alexander Hamilton had struck with the Constitution, dedicating his life to what he deemed a flawed document. "He was on principle opposed to Republican and attached to monarchical government," Morris wrote. Morris distorted and exaggerated Hamilton's views no less than his Republican enemies, but he identified a genuine, abiding conflict inside Hamilton as to whether Republican government could achieve the proper balance between liberty and order. Under the towering portico of Trinity Church, the funeral organizers had erected a carpeted stage with two chairs at the center, one for Governor Morris, the other for John Barker Church. Hamilton's casket rested on a bier in front of the stage. The sprawling crowd was so massive that when Morris spoke, his voice seemed to fade away in the vast space, turning his speech into an unintended dumb show for many of those squeezed onto Lower Broadway. In his oration, Morris was more just and generous toward Hamilton than in his grudging diary notes. He applauded Hamilton's bravery in the Revolution, cited his legitimate doubts as to whether the Constitution could avert anarchy and despotism, and noted that Hamilton, far from being artful or duplicitous, was in most ways excessively frank. Knowing the purity of his heart, he bore it, as it were, in his hand, exposing to every passenger its inmost recesses. This generous indiscretion subjected him to censure from misrepresentation. His speculative opinions were treated as deliberate designs, and yet you all know how strenuous, how unremitting were his efforts to establish and to preserve the Constitution. Morris sensed that the crowd was disappointed with his talk. The indignant spectators wanted to hoot and jeer lustily at Burr, who was never even mentioned. Moreover, the impact of Morris's words paled beside the arresting vignette of family grief presented to the spectators. Four of Hamilton's sons, Alexander, 18, James, 14, John, 11, and William, 6, sat weeping on the stage beside Morris. One paper recorded, "The scene was impressive, and what added unspeakably to its solemnity was the mournful group of tender boys, the sons, the once hopes and joys of the deceased, who, with tears gushing from their eyes, sat upon the stage at the feet of the orator, bewailing the loss of their parent." It was too much. The sternest powers, the bloodiest villain, could not resist the melting scene. Once Morris had finished his speech, the casket was transferred to a gravesite in the Trinity Churchyard, not far from where Hamilton had studied and lived, practiced law, and served his country. With Bishop Moore officiating, Hamilton's remains were deposited in the heart of the district that was to become the center of American finance. At the close, troops gathered around his grave, formed a neat square, and fired three volleys at intervals into the air. Hamilton was laid to rest with full honors in a martial style that would have gratified the most florid fantasies of the adolescent clerk on St. Croix, who had once prayed for a war to prove his valor. "This scene was enough to melt a monument of marble," said Hamilton's New York Evening Post. Thus ended the most dramatic and improbable life among the founding fathers. Because of his untimely death at 49, Hamilton has retained a freshness in our historical memory. He never lived to grow gray or acquire the stiff dignity of an elder statesman. "Somehow it is impossible to imagine Hamilton as an old man," Catherine Drinker Bowen once wrote. "Even his hard-headedness and relentless skepticism showed a quality not of caution, but of youthful daring, careless defiance." The brilliance of his life was matched only by its brevity. The average life expectancy was then about 55, so the dying Hamilton did not seem as young to his contemporaries as he does today, but many obituaries portrayed him as cut down by a bullet in his prime. Perhaps our impression of Hamilton's youthfulness has been magnified by the longevity of the first eight American presidents, who lived an average of nearly 80 years, with only Washington failing to reach his 70th birthday. Hamilton's relatively short life not only robbed him of any chance for further accomplishment, but of the opportunity to mold his historical image. Jefferson and Adams took advantage of the next two decades to snipe at Hamilton and burnish their own exploits through their lengthy correspondence and other writings. With his prolific pen and literary gifts, Hamilton would certainly have left voluminous and convincing memoirs. In death, as in life, the assessment of Hamilton's historical worth was sharply divided. His friends believed that a protean genius and rare spirit had exited the American scene. The Reverend John M. Mason thought him the greatest statesman in the Western world, perhaps the greatest man of the age. He has left none like him, no second, no third, nobody to put us in mind of him. His staggering catalog of achievements, compressed into a 30-year span, has been matched by few Americans. But not everyone mourned his departure. In after years, John Adams grumbled of the duel. No one wished to get rid of Hamilton in that way. Adams complained to Jefferson that Hamilton's death had been marked by a general grief, while Samuel Adams and John Hancock had died in comparative obscurity. In his autobiography, Adams took another potshot at Hamilton's death. Vice, folly, and villainy are not to be forgotten because the guilty wretch repented in his dying moments. James Madison seemed less concerned with Hamilton's death than the exploitation of it by his Federalist opponents. Writing to James Monroe, he noted that the newspapers which you receive will give you the adventure between Burr and Hamilton. You will easily understand the different uses to which the event is turned. Jefferson reacted to Hamilton's death in the oblique style that Hamilton knew only too well. 3 days after the funeral, almost as an afterthought in a letter to his daughter, Jefferson appended a postscript. "I presume Mr. Randolph's newspapers will inform him of the death of Colonel Hamilton, which took place on the 12th. Even now, Jefferson insisted on demoting General Hamilton back to a colonel. Aside from another fleeting reference to some remarkable deaths lately, Jefferson made no mention of the man who had been the bane of his political life for 14 years. After returning from Weehawken, Aaron Burr's boat docked at the foot of Canal Street, and he had proceeded on horseback to Richmond Hill with the blithe insouciance of a man who had just taken the morning air. Made of indestructible stuff, the Vice President of the United States was not one to be tormented by guilt or unduly disturbed by some bloodshed. According to his early biographer, James Parton, a young Connecticut relative dropped by Richmond Hill unannounced and found Burr in his library. Every inch the cordial host, Burr neglected to mention that he had shot Alexander Hamilton 2 hours earlier. While his antagonist was dying a half mile to the north, Burr breakfasted with his cousin and exchanged pleasantries about mutual friends. After the young relative left at about 10 o'clock, he was walking down Broadway when a friend accosted him with astonishing news. "Colonel Burr has killed General Hamilton in a duel this morning." "Why, no, he hasn't," said Burr's incredulous cousin. "I have just come from there and taken breakfast with him." "But I have this moment seen the news on the bulletin," his friend insisted. Many such anecdotes circulated after the duel, portraying the bloodless composure and macabre humor with which Burr reacted to Hamilton's death. Some reports spoke of revelry at Richmond Hill, while others said that Burr expressed regret only for not having shot Hamilton straight in the heart. Some of these tales were doubtless fabricated and rightly dismissed as Federalist propaganda. William Van Ness insisted that Burr, far from exhibiting any degree of levity or expressing any satisfaction at the result of the meeting with Hamilton, had shown only regret and concern. Indeed, right after the duel, Burr asked Dr. Hosack to stop by Richmond Hill and update him on Hamilton's condition. But that about sums up the extent of Aaron Burr's concern for Hamilton. For the rest of his life, he never uttered one word of contrition for having killed a man with a wife and 7 children and behaved as if Hamilton's family did not exist. The rumors of this sang-froid surfaced in so many quarters and so perfectly coincide with the tone of Burr's own letters as to inspire a certain credibility. On the day of Hamilton's death, Dirk ten Broeck wrote to his father, "Colonel Burr is at his house, seemingly perfectly at ease and from report seemingly in perfect composure." A Federalist paper, the Balance and Columbian Repository, conjured up a man flushed with his victory who cantered home after the duel and stopped to greet a married lady of his acquaintance, telling her with gaiety that it was a fine morning. The paper identified Burr's breakfast companion that morning as not his cousin, but his broker, Nathaniel Prime, summoned for an amiable business chat. The paper stated that it took a circle of 6 gentlemen to convince Prime afterward that Burr had fired a lethal shot at Alexander Hamilton that morning. If Burr reacted initially in cavalier fashion to the duel's outcome, it may have been because he did not yet know that Hamilton had informed both Pendleton and Rufus King of his plan to throw away his shot. To make this critical point stick, Hamilton repeated it several times on his deathbed and worked it into his farewell letters. As an artful lawyer, he had left behind a consistent trail of evidence for his posthumous vindication. Within a week, both Pendleton and Van Ness had published separate accounts of the duel and the correspondence leading up to it, sparking a hue and cry against Burr. Critics accused Burr of a premeditated plot to kill Hamilton, and overwrought citizens threatened to burn down his house. James Parton observed, "It was from that hour that Burr became a name of horror. The letters, for a person ignorant of the former history, were entirely damning to the memory of the challenger. They present Burr in the light of a revengeful demon, burning for an innocent victim's blood." Many Hamilton partisans believed that Burr had done more than just try to vindicate his honor, and that he had gunned down Hamilton in cold blood. One New York newspaper said that Hamilton had fallen by the hand of a base assassin. Thus, Hamilton triumphed posthumously over Burr, converting the latter's victory at Weehawken into his political coup de grace. Burr's reputation perished along with Hamilton, exactly as Hamilton had anticipated. Both the Jeffersonian and Federalist press canonized Hamilton and vied in detestation of Burr. We find the direful blow to have been the entire consequence and fixed purpose of Burr's own subtle, premeditated, fiend-like rancor, thundered a Maryland editorial. An editor in Charleston, South Carolina, speculated that Burr's heart must have been stuffed with cinders raked from the fires of hell. Burr scoffed at such reactions. He believed that he had suffered Hamilton's slander for an unusually long period, had obeyed the standard dueling conventions, and was being persecuted by Hamilton's hypocritical friends. "General Hamilton died yesterday," Burr told his son-in-law on July 13th. "The malignant Federalists, or Tories, and the embittered Clintonians unite in endeavoring to excite public sympathy in his favor and indignation against his antagonist. Thousands of absurd falsehoods are circulated with industry." It especially irked Burr that New York Republicans who had berated Hamilton for years were suddenly kneeling and genuflecting before his martyred image. The thick-skinned Burr probably could have faced down the sullen New York crowds. Then he learned that the city coroner had convened a jury to probe Hamilton's death. He knew that if he were indicted for murder, he might not be allowed to post bail, and so he began to mull over plans to leave town for several weeks. Ordinarily, gentlemen were not prosecuted for duels, and since the duel had occurred in New Jersey, Burr did not think New York even had jurisdictional authority. "You can judge what chance I should have in our courts on a trial for my life, though there is nothing clearer to a dispassionate lawyer than that the courts of this state have nothing to do with the death of General Hamilton," he told Charles Biddle. In plotting his next moves, Burr also had to contend with the fact that he was bankrupt. Just one day after Hamilton died, Burr wrote forlornly to William Van Ness, "Can you aid me?" Burr refused to allow duels, debts, or death threats to slow the racy tempo of his love life. On the night of July 20th, he made time for a parting tryst with his new love interest, La G, and boasted to Theodosia that she had shown a degree of sensibility and attachment toward him, which pleased him very much. That he had killed Hamilton 9 days earlier did not seem to affect his sexual appetite, and may even have enhanced it. The following evening, under cover of dark and attended by his 15-year-old slave Peter, Burr boarded a barge in the Hudson and fled from any retribution in New York and New Jersey. By July 24th, the fugitive vice president had arrived in Philadelphia, where he stayed on Chestnut Street with Charles Biddle, whose son Nicholas Biddle was one day to become president of the Second Bank of the United States. Even if he was a pariah, Burr was determined to enjoy his quota of fun. He contacted a favorite mistress, Celeste, and then told Theodosia Riley, "If any male friend of yours should be dying of ennui, recommend him to engage in a duel and a courtship at the same time." Such ghoulish humor was Burr's stock in trade. Despite assassination threats, he stayed with Biddle for 2.5 weeks and took only minimal precautions. Undeterred by hostile stares, he moved freely about the city. One paper reported Colonel Burr, the man who has covered our country with mourning, was seen walking with a friend in the streets of this city in open day. All the while, Burr received reports from New York that the coroner's jury was pursuing his friends and had clapped his close associate Matthew Davis into jail for not answering questions. On August 2, 1804, the coroner's jury delivered the verdict Burr had dreaded: that Aaron Burr, Esquire, Vice President of the United States, was guilty of the murder of Alexander Hamilton, and that William P. Van Ness and Nathaniel Pendleton were accessories. Arrest warrants were issued, but the situation was not nearly as dire for Burr as it seemed, as New York Governor Morgan Lewis protested Burr's prosecution as disgraceful, illiberal, and ungentlemanly. Nonetheless, Burr feared that the governor might be coerced into ordering his extradition from Pennsylvania, and he made plans to flee farther south. He was convinced that in the end the charges would not stick, but he had to wait for the public hubbub to subside. Indeed, on August 14th, a New York grand jury dropped the original murder indictment and replaced it with a lesser charge. Burr, Van Ness, and Pendleton were now accused of violating the law by sending a challenge to a duel. For his temporary hideaway, Burr chose a large slave plantation on St. Simon's Island, off the Georgia coast, an estate owned by his foppish friend Pierce Butler, the son of a baronet and a former senator. Before sailing south, Burr dabbled in the sort of secessionist mischief that Hamilton had feared, though of an even more treacherous nature. He held a secret meeting with British Ambassador Anthony Merry and assured him that he would cooperate in any British attempt to effect a separation of the western part of the United States from that which lies between the Atlantic and the mountains in its whole extent. Inasmuch as Burr was now a political outcast, rejected by both parties, and a reprobate into the bargain, Merry considered the situation promising. Burr passed several luxurious weeks on St. Simon's with Peter and a young friend, 21-year-old Samuel Swartwood. Outside of South Carolina, Southerners tended to sympathize with someone who had slain Alexander Hamilton, and Burr was showered with presents by the islanders. In early September, he toured the Spanish-controlled Floridas, posing as a London merchant and surveying the territory for a possible secessionist plot. Then he started his journey northward under the pseudonym R. King. In many towns, his transparent disguise was quickly penetrated, and he was received royally, especially in the Jeffersonian stronghold of Virginia. He may have imagined that he was on the road to political rehabilitation, only to learn in late October that a grand jury in Bergen County, New Jersey, had indicted him for murder. The indictment was later tossed out because Hamilton had died in New York. Burr was taking no chances, however, and continued to steer clear of both New Jersey and New York. With irreverent humor, he wondered to Theodosia which state shall have the honor of hanging the vice president. The indebted Burr had another motive for boycotting New York. His creditors had seized his assets, auctioned his furniture, and sold Richmond Hill to John Jacob Astor, who was to subdivide it into 400 small parcels and make a fortune. Now, $7,000 or $8,000 in debt, Burr would face legal proceedings from local creditors if he crossed the state line. For the moment, the safest place in America for the vice president was the nation's capital, where he could preside safely over the Senate. At the opening of Congress on November 4, 1804, it was more than a trifle startling for some legislators to see Aaron Burr settling into his chair on the Senate dais. Federalist William Plumer rubbed his eyes in disbelief. "The man whom the grand jury in the county of Bergen, New Jersey, have recently indicted for the murder of the incomparable Hamilton appeared yesterday and today at the head of the Senate. It certainly is the first time, and God grant it may be the last, that ever a man so justly charged with such an infamous crime presided in the American Senate." An acute observer, Plumer noted that Burr had dropped his nonchalant veneer. He appears to have lost those easy, graceful manners that beguiled the hours away in the last session. He is now uneasy, discontented, and hurried. Frozen out of Jefferson's administration for 4 years, Burr found a new warmth and hospitality in the wake of the duel. The president invited him to dine at the White House several times, and both Secretary of State Madison and Treasury Secretary Gallatin received him with newfound camaraderie. This may have expressed tacit contempt for Hamilton, but it also reflected another factor. As president of the Senate, Burr was to preside over the impeachment trial of Samuel Chase, an arch-federalist and associate justice of the Supreme Court who had derided the mobocracy of the Jeffersonian administration. Chase had been charged, among other things, with unbecoming conduct in the trial of James T. Callender under the Sedition Act. The trial was part of Jefferson's continuing assault on the Federalist-dominated judiciary, and the president's confidence was only bolstered when he and George Clinton trounced Charles C. Pinckney and Rufus King in a landslide victory in the 1804 election. In his final vendetta against Hamilton, Senator William Branch Giles of Virginia, who had harassed Hamilton with hostile resolutions as a congressman a decade earlier, organized a group of 11 Republican colleagues who appealed to New Jersey Governor Joseph Bloomfield to terminate Burr's prosecution. Notwithstanding his later denials, Burr instigated this lobbying effort. The senators argued that most civilized nations refuse to treat dueling deaths as common murders and pointed to the absence of penalties in previous New Jersey duels. Senator Plumer was disgusted by what he saw as the Republicans' two-faced embrace of Burr. "I never had any doubts of their joy for the death of Hamilton. My only doubts were whether they would manifest that joy by caressing his murderer." Governor Bloomfield spurned the appeal, and 3 years passed before New Jersey dismissed the indictment. William Plumer wasn't the only person who gagged at Burr's incongruous presence in the Senate when the Chase impeachment trial started on February 4, 1805. One newspaper registered its shock thus: "What a page will that be in the history of the present Democratic administration, that a man under an indictment for murder presided at the trial of one of the justices of the Supreme Court of the United States, accused of a petty misdemeanor." Chase was acquitted of all charges, while Burr was universally praised for his even-handed conduct of the trial. For the moment, things were looking brighter for Burr. Before he stepped down as vice president, one Republican senator defended his duel by citing David and Goliath and claiming that Burr was controversial only because our David had slain the Goliath of Federalism. On March 2nd, Burr delivered a celebrated farewell speech to the Senate in which he praised the institution as a sanctuary and a citadel of law, of order, of liberty. His words possessed such poignant eloquence, the speech was his farewell to public life, that they wrung tears from many colleagues. After leaving the vice presidency, Burr suffered instant political exile. He had outlived his brief usefulness for the Republicans, and his courtship of the Federalists had ended with him gunning down the party's erstwhile leader. He was now bankrupt and stateless, a wanted man, even if he flippantly dismissed the New Jersey indictment. "You treat with too much gravity the New Jersey affair," he lectured Theodosia. "It should be considered a farce, and you will yet see it terminated so as to leave only ridicule and contempt for its abettors." Beneath his inveterate banter, Burr was worried. "In New York, I am to be disfranchised, and in New Jersey, hanged. Having substantial objections to both, I shall not, for the present, hazard either, but shall seek another country." As a result of Hamilton's death, many reformers were denouncing dueling, though the archaic institution survived well into the 19th century, counting Andrew Jackson, Henry Clay, John Randolph, Stephen Decatur, Sam Houston, Thomas Hart Benton, August Belmont, and Jefferson Davis among its practitioners. With the restless spirit that had long perturbed Hamilton, Burr roamed through the Ohio and Mississippi river valleys, where frontier settlers tended to tolerate duels and despise Federalists. He explored various cabals with England to seize portions of American soil, including Louisiana and other territories west of the Appalachians, in order to forge a new empire. This would-be conquistador also meditated an auxiliary plot to march into Mexico and liberate it from Spanish rule. His admirers hailed Burr as a visionary patriot, bent upon adding Spanish colonies to America, while detractors, including Jefferson, detected an evil plan to detach territory from the Union. In 1807, Burr was arrested for treason and for trying to incite a war against Spain. He was acquitted by Chief Justice John Marshall, who applied a strict definition of treason. The acquittal only sharpened Jefferson's contempt for the original error of establishing a judiciary independent of the nation. For 4 years, the disgraced Burr traveled in Europe, resorting occasionally to the pseudonym H.E. Edwards to keep creditors at bay. Sometimes he lived in opulence with fancy friends and at other times languished in drab single rooms. This aging roué sampled opium and seduced willing noblewomen and chambermaids with a fine impartiality. All the while, he cultivated self-pity. I find that among the great number of Americans here and there, all are hostile to A.B. All. What a lot of rascals they must be to make war on one whom they do not know, on one who never did harm or wished harm to a human being, he recorded in his diary. He befriended the English utilitarian philosopher Jeremy Bentham and spoke to him with remarkable candor. He really meant to make himself emperor of Mexico, Bentham recalled. He told me I should be the legislator and he would send a ship of war for me. He gave me an account of his duel with Hamilton. He was sure of being able to kill him, so I thought it little better than murder. Always capable of irreverent surprises, Burr gave Bentham a copy of The Federalist. The shade of Alexander Hamilton rose up to haunt Burr at unexpected moments. In Paris, he called upon Talleyrand, who instructed his secretary to deliver this message to the uninvited caller. I shall be glad to see Colonel Burr, but please tell him that a portrait of Alexander Hamilton always hangs in my study, where all may see it. Burr got the message and left. By the time Burr sailed home in 1812 as Mr. A. Arnott, all charges had been dropped against him. To get back on his feet in New York, he borrowed a law library from Robert Troup and tried to revive his practice. A solitary figure who had relinquished interest in politics, he soon lost the last emotional props of his life. That summer, his adored grandson, Aaron Burr Alston, died at age 10. He still had his beloved Theodosia, however, whose portrait he had toted around Europe, cradling it in his lap during stagecoach trips. Though her husband was now governor of South Carolina, gossip claimed that he was abusing her. At the end of 1812, the morose Theodosia sailed for New York to join her father, but she never made it. She died at sea, age 29, the victim of either a storm or pirates. It was the heaviest blow that Burr ever weathered, so crushing that he described himself as severed from the human race. 4 years later, his son-in-law, Joseph Alston, died at 37. This rash of calamities recapitulated the stunning sequence of deaths that Burr had suffered as a child. Already a ghost of times past, Burr became a famous recluse, occasionally pointed out on the New York streets. He seldom socialized beyond a small circle of people. As for the duel with Hamilton, Burr almost never showed any remorse. Soon after returning to America, he visited his aunt, Rhoda Edwards, who worried about his immortal soul and warned him, "You have committed a great many sins against God, and you killed that great and good man, Colonel Hamilton. I beseech you to repent and fly to the blood and righteousness of the Redeemer for pardon." Burr found this rather quaint. "Oh, aunt, don't feel too badly," he replied. "We shall both meet in heaven." One day, Burr was walking down Nassau Street in New York when Chancellor James Kent happened to see him. Kent lost all control, swooped down on Burr, and started flailing at him with his cane. "You are a scoundrel, sir," Kent shouted. "A scoundrel." His legendary aplomb intact, Burr tipped his hat and said, "The opinions of the learned chancellor are always entitled to the highest consideration." Then he bowed and walked away. Burr never lost his sense of humor about having killed Hamilton and made facetious references to "my friend Hamilton, whom I shot." Once, in the Boston Athenaeum, Burr paused to admire a bust of Hamilton. "There was the poetry," he said, tracing creases in Hamilton's face with his finger. Another time, Burr paused at a tavern to refresh his horses and wandered over to a traveling waxworks exhibition. He suddenly came upon a tableau that represented him and Hamilton in the duel. Underneath ran this verse: O Burr, O Burr, what hast thou done? Thou hast shooted dead great Hamilton. You hid behind a bunch of thistle and shooted him dead with a great hoss pistol. In relating the story, Burr roared with laughter. Only once did Burr betray any misgivings about killing Hamilton. While reading the scene in Lawrence Stern's Tristram Shandy, in which the tender-hearted Uncle Toby picks up a fly and delicately places it outside a window instead of killing it, Burr is said to have remarked, "Had I read Stern more and Voltaire less, I should have known the world was wide enough for Hamilton and me." Burr lingered on for 24 years after he returned to America. In 1833, age 77, he mustered enough strength or cynicism for one final romance and married a fabulously wealthy widow, 58-year-old Eliza Jumel, who occupied a mansion in Washington Heights. Improbable legend claims that Hamilton once had a fling with her. Nay, Betsy Bowen, she had started life as a courtesan and bore an illegitimate son before marrying the rich wine merchant Stephen Jumel. Burr, as usual, behaved like a scamp and frittered away Madame Jumel's money while being unfaithful. A year later, she filed for divorce and accused her incorrigible husband of adultery. Why had she expected Burr to reform at this late hour? On September 14, 1836, he died in a Staten Island hotel after two strokes and was buried in Princeton near his father and grandfather. The death mask of Aaron Burr is haunting and unforgettable, with the nose twisted to the left, the mouth crooked, and the expression grotesque, as if all the suppressed pain of his life were engraved in his face by the end. John Quincy Adams left this epitaph of the man. Burr's life, take it all together, was such as in any country of sound morals his friends would be desirous of burying in profound oblivion. Epilogue. Eliza. For Eliza Hamilton, the collapse of her world was total, overwhelming, and remorseless. Within 3 years, she had had to cope with four close deaths: her eldest son, her sister Peggy, her mother, and her husband, not to mention the mental breakdown of her eldest daughter. Because the news of Hamilton's death further weakened the already precarious health of Philip Schuyler, Eliza stayed in Albany to nurse him. As his gout flared up anew, he hobbled about in tremendous pain and became bedridden. "I trust that the Supreme Being will prolong my life that I may discharge the duties of a father to my dear child and her dear children," Philip Schuyler told Angelica Church. "Eliza knows how tenderly I loved my dear Hamilton, how tenderly I love her and her children." The Supreme Being, alas, had other plans for the ailing general. On November 18th, 1804, 4 months after his son-in-law slumped to the ground in Weehawken, Philip Schuyler died and was buried in the Albany Rural Cemetery. How did Eliza soldier on after these dreadful events that came thick and fast upon her? A month after the duel, she answered a sympathy note from Colonel William S. Smith, who had written to inform her that the Society of the Cincinnati would erect a monument to Hamilton in Trinity Church. In her letter, Eliza alluded to the forces that would sustain her. Suffering from the irreparable loss of a most amiable and affectionate husband, she prayed for the mercies of the divine being in whose dispensations all Christians should acquiesce. Beyond religious solace, she drew strength from sympathetic friends and family members and the veneration paid to her husband. She wrote, "The wounded heart derives a degree of consolation from the tenderness with which its loss is bewailed by the virtuous, the wise, and humane, and that high honor and respect with which the memory of the dear deceased has been commemorated." Eliza's fierce, unending loyalty to Hamilton certifies that their marriage had been deeply rewarding, albeit marred by Maria Reynolds and other misadventures. Blessed with a forgiving heart, Eliza made ample allowance for her husband's flaws. 2 months after the duel, she described Hamilton to Nathaniel Pendleton as "my beloved, sainted husband and my guardian angel." She thought that God, in snatching Hamilton away, had balanced the ledgers of her life, inflicting exquisite pain equal to her matchless joy in marriage. "I have remarked to you that I have had a double share of blessings, and I must now look forward to grief. For such a husband, his spirit is in heaven and his form in the earth, and I am nowhere any part of him is. She pored so frequently over his letters to her that they began to crack and crumble into dust. Around her neck, she wore a tiny bag containing brittle yellow scraps of the love sonnet that Hamilton had given to her during their courtship in Morristown. The scraps were sewn together as the paper decomposed, and the intimate farewell letter he had prepared for her on the eve of the duel. Eliza retained boundless affection for her Hamilton, even though he had left her stranded in a terrible financial predicament. Hamilton died illiquid, if not insolvent. This mocked the hardy Republican fairy tale that he had enriched himself as Treasury Secretary and colluded with British paymasters. The secret London bank account that legend said awaited him when the monarchy returned to America, a staple of Jeffersonian lore, had never existed. America's financial wizard earned comparatively little in his lifetime, and his executors feared that any distressed sale of his assets, chiefly the Grange and some land in western New York and the Ohio River Valley, would slash their value. Governor Morris was appalled by the magnitude of Hamilton's debts and confided to Rufus King, "Our friend Hamilton has been suddenly cut off in the midst of embarrassments which would have required years of professional industry to set straight. A debt of between $50,000 and $60,000 hanging over him, a property which in time may sell for $70,000 or $80,000, but which, if brought to the hammer, would not in all probability fetch $40,000. Philip Schuyler had already disposed of a considerable portion of his wealth among his 8 children and their descendants. His entire estate of $35,000 could not have covered Hamilton's debts, so Eliza's inheritance fell dreadfully short of Hamilton's more sanguine expectations. She inherited farmland around Albany and Saratoga that yielded a paltry $750 in annual income and did not begin to defray her expenses. Heavily indebted from abortive business ventures, Philip Schuyler died land rich but cash poor. The aura of Schuyler family wealth had outdistanced reality. To keep the family afloat, Governor Morris organized a secret subscription fund among Hamilton's friends. He had to conquer an automatic assumption that the Hamilton children, with their rich grandfather, would never know want. Morris and more than 100 other subscribers poured in about $80,000, while New England Federalists donated Pennsylvania land as well. This fund was such a closely guarded secret that Hamilton's children did not know of it for a generation, and the Bank of New York managed to keep its existence confidential until 1937. The executors did not dare to dispossess Eliza from the Grange, so they bought it for $30,000 and sold it back to her at half price, ensuring that she could stay there indefinitely. If such generosity preserved Eliza from indigence, it did not spare her incessant anxiety about money and the humiliating need to cadge small loans. 3 years after the duel, she appealed to Nathaniel Pendleton for an emergency handout, telling him that as I am nearly out of cash, I take the liberty to ask you to negotiate a loan of $300. Eliza, though never prodigal, had grown up in comfort and now learned to cultivate thrift. Notwithstanding her financial plight, she heeded one sacred injunction in Hamilton's farewell letter: to take care of his now blind, poor cousin, Anne Mitchell. Eliza invited her to stay at the Grange for extended periods and bailed her out with a $630 gift in 1810. Eliza never wavered in her belief that the government owed substantial debts, financial and intangible, to her husband. At the end of the Revolution, Hamilton had waived the pension to which he was entitled as an army officer. From scruples of delicacy as a member of Congress, he had sought to eliminate any personal conflict of interest as he pondered the vexed question of veterans' compensation. In a similarly high-minded spirit, he had waived his right to the bounty lands awarded to other officers. No amateur when it came to political timing, Eliza bided her time until Jefferson left the White House in 1809 and then immediately lobbied the apparently more forgiving President Madison for relief. By the time Madison left office, the persistent Eliza Hamilton had prevailed upon Congress to award her the cash equivalent of 450 acres in bounty lands plus 5 years' worth of full army pay, about $10,000. It was a huge struggle for Eliza to educate her children on a modest, fluctuating income. She bemoaned having to raise them in a world of disastrous events and evil passions, but she did a creditable job. Her five surviving sons gravitated to careers in the Hamiltonian mold: law, government, and the military. The second son, Alexander, graduated from Columbia weeks after his father's duel. Eliza said that it was the wish of my beloved, departed husband that his son Alexander should be placed in a counting house to be bred a merchant. But when Stephen Higginson invited Alexander to apprentice in his Boston firm, Eliza could not bear losing her eldest surviving son to another city. Unnerved by affliction and broken down by distress, she told Higginson, what can be my wishes but to have the children of the best, the tenderest husband always with me? Alexander became a lawyer, fought abroad in the Duke of Wellington's army, returned to America as an infantry captain during the War of 1812, and wound up as a U.S. district attorney in New York. With fine irony, he represented Eliza Jumel when she divorced the unfaithful Aaron Burr. The third son, James Alexander Hamilton, graduated from Columbia, served as an officer in the War of 1812, was an acting Secretary of State under President Andrew Jackson, and as such favored the abolition of the Second Bank of the United States, and became a U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. An easygoing, fast-talking man, he published a newspaper and developed a close friendship with Martin Van Buren, sometimes regarded as a natural child of Aaron Burr. At first, James A. Hamilton defended slavery as constitutional, then during the Civil War proved an early supporter of emancipation. In homage to his father's birthplace, he created a home called Nevis on the Hudson. The fourth son, John Church Hamilton, was a lawyer, also fought in the War of 1812, and devoted decades to writing a many-volumed life of his father and sorting through his labyrinthine papers. The fifth son, William Stephen, was charming, handsome, and eccentric. After studying at West Point, he fought in the Black Hawk War, surveyed public lands in Illinois, and enjoyed a bachelor's, free-spirited life on the western frontier. In 1849, he flocked to the California Gold Rush and opened a store in Sacramento to sell supplies to miners. He died there of cholera in 1850, the only child other than the elder Philip to predecease Eliza. The sixth son, Little Phil, was a kind-hearted, sensitive man. He married the daughter of Lewis McLean, Secretary of the Treasury and Secretary of State under Andrew Jackson. Phil served as an assistant U.S. attorney under his brother James, but leaned toward altruistic pursuits and developed a reputation as the lawyer of the poor. The eldest daughter, Angelica, lingered on under a physician's care and remained the sad charge of Eliza's bleeding heart, according to a friend. She died in 1857. The younger daughter, Eliza Hamilton Holly, assumed the burden of caring for her mother in her later years. For 10 years after the duel, Eliza clung to the indispensable support of her sister Angelica, her strongest bond to the past, and to her fallen husband. A fixture of New York society, Angelica kept busy attending balls and parties until the end. In 1806, her son Philip took a large tract of land that he had inherited in upstate New York and established the town of Angelica in her honor. In March 1814, Angelica Church died at 57 and was buried in the same Trinity churchyard that held the brother-in-law who had so lastingly captivated her. John Barker Church returned to England and died in London in April 1818. In her first decades of widowhood, Eliza had to endure an endless parade of presidents. Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, and John Quincy Adams, who had crossed swords with her husband and had no desire to gild his memory. As federalism became a term of abuse, she embarked on a single-minded crusade to do justice to her husband's achievements. After the Reverend John M. Mason, Timothy Pickering, and others failed to produce the major biography that she craved, she turned to her son, John Church Hamilton, to edit Hamilton's papers and produce a massive history that would duly glorify the patriarch. Eliza buttonholed elderly politicians and peppered them with detailed questionnaires, soliciting their recollections of her husband. She traveled to Mount Vernon and borrowed letters that Hamilton had written to Washington. She knew that she was racing against the clock, against mortality, against the vanishing trove of mementos of the revolutionary years. I have my fears I shall not obtain my object, she wrote to her daughter Eliza of the seemingly jinxed project in 1832. Most of the contemporaries of your father have also passed away. The immense biographical project was not completed until 7 years after Eliza's death. The decades that she devoted to conserving her husband's legacy made Eliza only more militantly loyal to his memory, and there was one injury she could never forget: the exposure of the Mariah Reynolds affair, for which she squarely blamed James Monroe. In the 1820s, after Monroe had completed 2 terms as president, he called upon Eliza in Washington, D.C., hoping to thaw the frost between them. Eliza was then about 70 and staying at her daughter's home. She was sitting in the backyard with her 15-year-old nephew when a maid emerged and presented the ex-president's card. Far from being flattered by this distinguished visitor, Eliza was taken aback. She read the name and stood holding the card, much perturbed, said her nephew. Her voice sank and she spoke very low, as she always did when she was angry. What has that man come to see me for? The nephew said that Monroe must have stopped by to pay his respects. She wavered. I will see him, she finally agreed. So the small woman with the upright carriage and the sturdy, determined step marched stiffly into the house. When she entered the parlor, Monroe rose to greet her. Eliza then did something out of character and socially unthinkable. She stood facing the ex-president, but did not invite him to sit down. With a bow, Monroe began what sounded like a well-rehearsed speech, stating that it was many years since they had met, that the lapse of time brought its softening influences, that they both were nearing the grave when past differences could be forgiven and forgotten. Eliza saw that Monroe was trying to draw a moral equation between them and apportion blame equally for the long rupture in their relationship. Even at this late date, 30 years after the fact, she was not in a forgiving mood. Mr. Monroe, she told him, if you have come to tell me that you repent, that you are sorry, very sorry, for the misrepresentations and the slanders and the stories you circulated against my dear husband, if you have come to say this, I understand it. But otherwise, no lapse of time, no nearness to the grave, makes any difference. Monroe took in this rebuke without comment. Stunned by the fiery words delivered by the elderly little woman in widow's weeds, the ex-president picked up his hat, bid Eliza good day, and left the house, never to return. Because Eliza Hamilton tried to erase herself from her husband's story, she has languished in virtually complete historical obscurity. To the extent that she has drawn attention, she has been depicted as a broken, weeping, neurasthenic creature, clinging to her Bible and lacking any identity other than that of Hamilton's widow. In fact, she was a woman of towering strength and integrity who consecrated much of her extended widowhood to serving widows, orphans, and poor children. On March 16, 1806, less than 2 years after the duel, Eliza and other evangelical women co-founded the New York Orphan Asylum Society, the first private orphanage in New York. Perhaps nothing expressed her affection for Hamilton more tenderly than her efforts on behalf of orphans. If Eliza did not draft the society's constitution, she endorsed its credo that crime has not been the cause of the orphan's misery, and future usefulness may yet be the result of his or her protection. God himself has marked the fatherless as the peculiar subjects of his divine compassion. Surely some extra dimension of religious fervor had entered into Eliza's feelings toward her husband because of his boyhood. She possessed her own pitying, loving nature, blended with a rare sense of justice, said her friend Jessie Benton Fremont. All these she dedicated to the care of orphan children. For many years, Eliza was a mainstay of the orphanage board and held the position of second directress, or deputy director. She was present in 1807 when the cornerstone was laid for its 2-story wooden headquarters in Greenwich Village. In 1821, Eliza was elevated to first directress, with the chief responsibility for the 158 children then housed and educated in the asylum. For the next 27 years, with a tenacity that Hamilton would have savored, she oversaw every aspect of the orphanage work. She raised money, leased properties, visited almshouses, investigated complaints, and solicited donations of coal, shoes, and Bibles. She often gave the older orphans jobs in her home and helped one gain admittance to West Point. With a finesse reminiscent of her husband's, she handled the society's funds on the finance committee. After obtaining a state charter for the society, she lobbied the state legislature for annual grants. "Mama, you are a sturdy beggar," her son once teased her. "My dear son," she retorted, "I cannot spare myself or others. My Maker has pointed out this duty to me and has given me the ability and inclination to perform it." She was still first directress in 1836 when the cornerstone was laid for an imposing new orphanage at 73rd Street and Riverside Drive. Eliza led the organization cheerfully, willingly, aided by her dear friend Joanna Bethune. "My mother's regard and esteem for this venerable lady continually increased," George Bethune said of his mother's warm friendship with Eliza. Both were of determined disposition. Mrs. Bethune was the more cautious, Mrs. Hamilton the more impulsive, so that occasions of dispute did occur. But it was charming to see how affectionately these temporary altercations soon terminated in mutual embraces. Like her evangelical colleagues, Eliza believed passionately that all children should be literate in order to study the Bible. In 1818, she returned to the state legislature and won a charter for the Hamilton Free School, which was the first educational institution in the Washington Heights section of Manhattan. It stood on land Eliza donated on Broadway between 187th and 188th Streets in Upper Manhattan and was established in honor of her husband's memory. A painting of Eliza from later years shows a woman with a strong but kindly face and a firm, determined mouth. Her silver hair was parted down the middle under her widow's cap, and her dark eyes were still large and girlishly bright. Her face is delicate but full of nerve and spirit. "The eyes are very dark and hold the life and energy of the restraining face," said Jesse Benton Fremont, who marveled at Eliza's unabated vigor. "When I first lived on the Hudson River, quite near her son's home, it was still remembered how the old lady, past 80, would leave the train at a way station and climb two fences in her shortcut across meadows, rather than go on to the town where the carriage could meet her." Her willpower and spunk surprised people. At one anniversary celebration of the Orphan Asylum Society, Eliza, then in her 90s, materialized, to everyone's amazement. A very small, upright little figure in deep black, never altered from the time her dark hair was first framed by the widow's cap until now the hair was white as the cap. Fremont noted how she retains in an astonishing degree her faculties and converses with much of that ease and brilliancy which lent so peculiar a charm to her younger days. In 1848, the 91-year-old Eliza moved to Washington, D.C. to live with her younger daughter Eliza, who was now widowed after the death of her husband, Sidney Augustus Holly. At their H Street residence near the White House, Eliza Hamilton cherished her status as a relic of the American Revolution. Like her husband, she was a committed abolitionist who delighted in entertaining slave children from the neighborhood, and she referred derisively to the slaveholding states as the African states. Always busy knitting or making mats, she was an irresistible curiosity to visitors and a coveted ornament at White House dinners. "Mrs. General Hamilton, upon whom I waited at table, is a very remarkable person," President James K. Polk reported in his diary after one such dinner in February 1846. "She retains her intellect and memory perfectly, and my conversation with her was highly interesting." Eliza aided her friend Dolly Madison in raising money to construct the Washington Monument and remained sharp and alert until the end. When historian Benson J. Lossing interviewed her when she was 91, he found her anything but tearful or morose. The sunny cheerfulness of her temper and quiet humor still made her deportment genial and attractive. During the winter of 1852 to 1853, Eliza and her daughter enjoyed the company of a young relative named Elizabeth Hawley, who was startled by the constant stream of visitors who showed up at their doorstep. On the morning of New Year's Day, 1853, the young woman was disheartened by the gray skies and the apparent paucity of gentlemen callers. "But before noon, the sky cleared and the tide of visitors flowed in," she wrote to her aunt. "The rooms were crowded all day, and we received several hundred callers. Gentlemen brought their children to see Mrs. Hamilton. Many called who went to no other place, and as you are fond of hearing all, I wish I had room to tell you the names of the most distinguished senators, members, etc. General Winfield Scott showed up, looking dashing in his uniform, followed by New York Senator William H. Seward. Then the dense throng parted, and, to the young woman's amazement, President Millard Fillmore advanced across the room toward Eliza. I had heard he was thinner than when I saw him, but I never saw him looking stouter or handsomer. He sat with Mrs. Hamilton some time and asked her to appoint some time to dine with him. When the 95-year-old Eliza dined at the White House a month later, she made a grand entrance with her daughter. President Fillmore fussed over her, and the First Lady gave up her chair to her. Everybody was eager to touch a living piece of American history. A devout woman, Eliza never lost her faith that she and Hamilton would be gloriously reunited in the afterlife. She prized a small envelope that Hamilton had once sent her, with a romantic inscription emblazoned across the back, "I heal all wounds but those which love hath made." For Eliza, those wounds had never healed. On November 9th, 1854, a turbulent year in which the Kansas-Nebraska Act was enacted and the union that Hamilton had done so much to forge stood gravely threatened, Elizabeth Schuyler Hamilton died at age 97. Her widowhood had lasted 50 years, or slightly longer than her life before the duel. She was buried where she had always longed to be, right beside her Hamilton in the Trinity Churchyard. This is Scott Brick. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Alexander Hamilton by Ron Chernow. To find out more about the complete Books on Tape catalog of unabridged audiobooks, call our customer service department at the number on this package or visit us online at booksontape.com. Alexander Hamilton. Copyright 2004 by Ron Chernow. Published by arrangement with the Penguin Press, a member of Penguin Group USA, Incorporated. Production copyright 2004. Penguin Audiobooks and Books on Tape.